We've learned that quiet isn't always peace.
Leaders of the world, you must lead. The continuation of our civilizations is in your hands.
And to the children of our country, regardless of your gender, dream with ambition, lead with conviction.
The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not.
The second female prime minister, but certainly not the last.
The march towards freedom and justice is irreversible.
You're listening to Humble Pie, the podcast about humble leadership.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Humble Pie, and welcome also to my co-host, Harriet Courage.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Sarah Collins?
Yes, very well, thank you. Since the last time that we were here, Harriet has purchased a new pair of glasses, which make her look like she is some sort of publishing...
Oh, nice, yeah.
...aficionado. I can just see you as like the editor of Vogue or something wearing those glasses. And the relevance of that will all become clear later in the show, because today we have an interview with somebody from the publishing industry who is going to be super, super fascinating and interesting. But before we do that, let's have a brief discussion about what we've got coming up on today's show.
So today we're going to have a little chat about our humble selves. And then we've got our humble guest, who you've alluded to a little bit there, is from the publishing world. And we're going to ask them about their career and also a time when they've had to eat humble pie themselves, which I always love asking our guests. And then we've got our humble review. So this is something you can read, watch, and listen to get you inspired about leadership. But this week, to get you inspired about leadership is probably a little bit of a stretch, because it's a bit of a fun one today.
Good. And relevant to publishing.
Exactly.
The theme of today's show is going to be a little bit about ethical dilemmas, big and small. Later on, we'll talk about some bigger ones. But firstly, I'm keen to hear a little bit from you, Haz, about any ethical dilemmas that you faced recently, any examples that you can give our listeners.
I mean, the big ones come to mind of, like, you know, huge things that happen that are on the news and stuff like that. But actually, you know, every day is an ethical dilemma, especially when you have a four-year-old living in your house. And the other day, she had a little play date, and they were chatting away as they do. And I overheard her. So I just had my hair cut and I came back, and her friend said, "Your mum looks like she's got a boy's haircut." And in that moment, I was like, oh, do I sweep in and have the conversation? Because it's a big conversation to have. You've got to talk about gender equality, like how anyone can have their own hair and all of that kind of stuff. Or do I just leave it? Like, yeah. I could literally just walk away and go and make lunch and just be done.
I'm really busy. I don't have time for this. But so what did you do? Let me guess. You dived in with a big sit down discussion about.
Of course. I was like, I don't want to be like, I don't want to like scare them. Like, obviously I was a bit like riled up, and I was like, no, like, so I was like, okay, I need to like just have a cool, calm conversation about this. And also, I didn't want Olive to feel like her friend had made her feel like her mum had a boy's haircut. Like, I know that deep down Olive doesn't feel like that. Like,
yeah.
But I was like, you know, it's a really good thing to have this conversation. Yeah. So I sat them both down, explained that they're both like, I hate that they're so obsessed with princesses, because all the princesses in the Disney films all have this like beautiful long flowy hair. And even the good, like the cool new princesses like Elsa, who doesn't get saved by men and stuff like that, she's still got like blonde, amazing flowy hair and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They need to have a short hair princess soon.
Yeah, they do. Or a princess who kind of wears her hair up as like a massive horse.
Yeah.
You know, rather than,
do you know what?
Mulan, because she's trying to look like a man.
There is a scene in Moana where Moana means business, and she literally puts her hair up, and it's so great.
Oh, nice.
Because she's scoops it all up, and she's like, right, I'm ready now. Like,
I'm ready to take to the sea.
I'm ready. I can do anything now I've got my hair up. But yeah, so I had the whole conversation, and I was like, and also I wanted to highlight as well that actually, because I know that there are like a couple of boys in their class, especially in their year, that have long hair. And like, and I didn't want them to be perpetuating that normality that boys have short hair and girls have long hair. You know, everybody should just be able to have whatever kind of hair they want.
Oh my gosh, it's fascinating how young, the age at which children learn these kinds of stereotypes and things that they just know and understand about the world just from feeling their way around it for 4 years. It's mad, isn't it? Mm. I think so. And in terms of sort of that, those dilemmas, the things that we face day in, day out, that definitely applies to work as well. And obviously, you know, for us in our industry, in our little corner of the world, there's a huge discussion about ethics when it comes to PR, because people have this kind of old, outdated perception that PR is just full of people who are just spinning stories and kind of like saying whatever it takes to position their client in the right way. And actually, it's kind of, it couldn't be further from the truth. And I think that we are really moving forward in terms of like accountability and transparency. And for Don't Cry Wolf, obviously being a B Corp is a big part of that. And kind of some of our values are really, really focused upon transparency and honesty. Obviously, there's still more work to do. And I think if we look at the theme of today's show, the media, there's obviously been hugely high profile cases of, you know, big ethical dilemmas. And I guess, you know, the most recent one is probably the Martin Bashir BBC whistleblower scandal, which, you know, just shows that years later, these things can kind of come back and we can be confronted with these huge ethical dilemmas and things that have happened that, you know, day to day, you wouldn't necessarily think that that these conversations were being had behind closed doors. But you sometimes are, and we're all faced with perhaps something that feels like a really tempting opportunity, the opportunity to get a scoop like Martin Bashir had with Diana versus doing the right thing. And I think that is oftentimes a really, really tricky line to tread, isn't it? And it doesn't matter how big or small it is, it's always, always there. And definitely it's going to be one of the things that we are going to be talking to our guest about today, particularly because she is in the media, in the publishing industry. Haz, do you want to introduce our guest?
Today's guest has a wealth of experience in PR and communications, consulting leading brands, including P&G, Unilever, Microsoft, Virgin Media, to name a few. And she also spent several years working at the BBC as a journalist. And now Effie Kanua is Director of PR and Communications at Hearst UK.
Effie, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. And thanks for having me. I'm really excited about this. So I'm Effie Kanua and I'm the Director of PR and Comms at Hearst UK. And maybe some people don't know about Hearst UK, but we're a luxury premium content business. We've got 23 titles. So everything from our luxury titles like Harper's Bazaar, Elle, Esquire, right through to sort of Good Housekeeping, our health titles, which I love. You'll know that I'm a bit of a fitness junkie, so Men's Health, Women's Health, Runner's World, and then other iconic brands such as Cosmopolitan and Red, etc. So lots of amazing titles, and I essentially head up our comms function, which looks after the sort of corporate, consumer, internal comms and our events, which have obviously shifted to hybrid events. So it's a busy role. It's a busy role, but I've got a great team and I love it.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you actually, you've just made me think about the events, because obviously we see you on Instagram. I ordinarily see you at events and kind of going about your business during the day, and then also going out three times a week with work, because obviously it's incredibly busy. That must have been just an overnight change. Like how did that kind of affect you in the team when you weren't going out all the time? Was it quite a welcome break, or was it just sort of one of those things where you just think, wow, what are we going to do?
Well, we used to have what we used to call event season, which was pretty much from September right through to December. And it wasn't just our events like Harper's Bazaar Women of the Year, which is probably our sort of most famous one. And, that's like held at Claridge's, you know, amazing. You've got everyone from Victoria Beckham to sort of Keira Knightley, Amanda Siegfried, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, just like amazing sort of people that come. And it's all about sort of celebrating women who have been inspirational, whether, you know, authors or designers, you know, activists. We do a lot to sort of champion women within Harper's Bazaar. And so that's our kind of sort of big moment, but it is, you know, like a really amazing star-studded event. And, you know, things like Esquire Townhouse, we had Alexander Skarsgård that went down really well with the team and, you know, lots of sort of different events. And that period, you're right, I was probably out maybe 3-4 nights a week, and you've obviously got your working day, and then you've got these events, and you're sort of rolling in at 1-2 in the morning, and then you have to go back in. And, you know, pretty much by the end of it, the entire team were battered. And so we used to almost like psych ourselves up to September for that sort of, you know, 3-month period where we would literally write off our lives and get no sleep. So we ended up getting, you know, that back because we didn't have to sort of do all of those award ceremonies and events. But actually, right at the start of the pandemic, we were due to have Women's Health Live, which is a huge event we hold in at the Islington Design Centre. And it has about sort of 10,000 people over a couple of days sort of coming in to do, you know, mindfulness sessions, yoga workouts, you know, listening to all the amazing fitness influencers. And the pandemic happened, and so that big event that was supposed to happen couldn't. And, you know, we had to speak to, like, you know, all the people that were attending. We had people who were flying in from LA, you know, all of the people that were sort of exhibiting at the event. And in a matter of maybe a couple of weeks, we had to turn it into a virtual event. And that was back at the time when no one had really done virtual.
When was it? When was it supposed to be?
I think it was in April.
Oh my goodness. So like really early days.
I think if my memory serves me well. And it really was sort of just everyone, all the teams, the events team, the sponsorship team, the editorial teams, really just working through to make sure that we could put on this amazing event. And actually we shifted it to a Facebook Live event. Right. And it was free. So obviously, you know, there was the impact in terms of revenue because obviously, you know, we charged for the event and we had sponsors, etc. But what we had instead was, and I guess at a time where we were all pretty much locked down, that people could do these amazing home workouts and attend all of these sessions for free with all of this amazing talent that still wanted to very much be involved with the event. And we kind of continued on that path ever since. So we've done loads of events. You know, we've shifted Harper's Bazaar Summit, Esquire Townhouse, and it's worked really well for us, but it's been a massive learning curve.
It's interesting that you say that you had to take everything online and onto Facebook in particular, because one of the things that we said right at the beginning to a lot of our clients, obviously we had to kind of change everything that we were doing, but we said, you know, in the first few months of the lockdown, that you can either be really useful to people or you can be entertaining and try and kind of lift them out of their, you know, the misery that we're all experiencing at the moment as a result of lockdown, but nothing else. So just be useful or be entertaining, otherwise be quiet, because there was so much, wasn't there, going on then. And that's why it's so important that you went on to Facebook and that you could actually still share it with people, because you were doing both of those things, right? You were entertaining people, you were engaging with people. People needed that light relief. And the fact that you did it for free is incredible. And I think that's probably a bit of an example of what we wanted to talk with you about mostly today, which is, I suppose, this idea of like brand activism. Obviously we're a brand activism agency, but whether media brands should be engaging with activism, because obviously traditionally you would think that media brands wouldn't necessarily come down on one side of the debate. You'd think they would be relatively neutral. At least that's what they're supposed to be. Everybody knows that that's not the case. So do you think that publishers should kind of come down on one side of a debate or a social issue, or do you think they should sort of keep their opinions to themselves and just report on what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I've kind of been on both sides. So I actually started off at the BBC as a journalist, and that is very much being very sort of fair and neutral and just reporting the news factually as it is. And I, you know, I do think that as a broadcaster, it's the same when I was at Bauer Media and working on our sort of radio division. When you're a broadcaster, you have a responsibility to be neutral. I think it's different when it comes to publishers and magazines, just because, you know, the same way that newspapers, you get newspapers that have very sort of strong beliefs and I want to call them values. I don't know if you can sometimes categorize it as that, but you know, they either, you know, lean to the right or lean to the left, yeah. And they have a very clear point of view. I think what's great for us is that we've got all of these amazing brands that are almost like personalities in themselves. So if you think about something like Harper's Bazaar, it's all very much about sort of heritage, it's about luxury, it's about female entrepreneurship, it's about, you know, celebrating amazing women who are at the top of their game and sort of trying to change the world. And so for them to be involved in a debate around sort of activism, you know, for their audience feels right. And then you look at a brand like Cosmopolitan, and it really is, you know, kind of there on the sort of cutting edge of everything that, you know, a much younger demographic is interested in. And so in terms of, you know, Cosmopolitan, it really is about, you know, championing diversity and belonging. So whether that's, you know, on the basis of gender or ethnicity or LGBTQ plus rights. And that's what they've always done. They've always made really brave choices. And that's reflected not only in terms of the content that they produce, but also the covers that they do. And I don't know if you remember a few years back, but we put Tess Holliday on the cover and it actually won like cover of the year. And for some reason, having a larger than life plus size model on the cover of a magazine caused, it wasn't a national debate, it was a global debate. It was picked up in the US. We had Piers Morgan, who branded it as disgusting, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we were on GMB, you know, the whole thing. And it was a big deal to have a woman who is reflective of society on the cover of essentially, you know, a fashion magazine, a women's magazine. Why should that be a big deal? And we followed, we've had Jonathan Van Ness on the cover, and we've just had actually our first non-binary model, Ollie Allais, on the cover of Elle magazine, and that's the first for us. And so we've always been sort of very clear about taking a stand on what we believe in terms of the brand and standing by it and sort of trying at the forefront of it. And I think it's really important for brands to do, but it has to be authentic, right? That's the difference. Yeah. You sometimes see brands that do things that kind of feel like they're jumping on the bandwagon, and that doesn't work. You have to do something that fits your brand, your personality, and that your audience will buy into.
When you had her on the cover, did you ever predict, like, this is going to become a global debate?
Well, it was actually before my time, and they were kind of aware, but I just don't think they estimated the level of interest. And the thing is, like, we had two sides. We had the women and our readers who were like, well done, Cosmopolitan. Thank you for finally sort of representing, you know, women like me. Like, that's the thing. It's about reflecting society and all of the amazing diverse facets and shapes and sizes and definitions of beauty that we have in society. And so you had those people that kind of felt, you know, heard and seen for the first time and that felt positive about themselves. And then you got the others who thought it was disgusting and promoting and glamorizing obesity and all of those really unhelpful things. And you know, that wasn't the point. The reason she was actually on the cover was to discuss mental health, because that was something that the magazine really championed and was something that they wanted to take a point of view on. And so her interview and her premise was, here she was, you know, a model, and she was here to talk about mental health. Mm. That was the focus, but then it turned into something around body shape.
But then I guess because it was authentic and because there was a reason that she was on the cover and she had something interesting to talk about that would be interesting to the readers, it was exactly the right thing to do, exactly the right time, for exactly the right audience. And that's where it just, it's about being relevant, isn't it? It's just about being authentic and relevant and making sure that you do have a position that makes sense, rather than, as you say, some people who are still, even now, you know, greenwashing, purpose washing, bandwagon jumping, whatever it is you want to call it, there's still so much of that out there. And it's just really, it's very thin, isn't it? And you do see through it, I think, quite easily. Do you have a favourite cover or campaign that, or are you not allowed to say what your favourite is?
It's so funny because, like, as comms director, you have to be sort of neutral. Like, yeah, you can't have a favourite. But like,
I imagine them to be like your children, being like, with all your different, like how you were talking about their personalities earlier. I can imagine you really develop like these personas for each of the, like for each of the different titles. And you're like, no, you can't have a favorite child.
Yeah, it's exactly that. I mean, you have to be diplomatic. I mean, I like different titles for different things. Obviously, I'm massively into fitness, so I love everything that our health titles do. And you know, Men's Health, for example, has just put Marcus Rashford on the cover, and I think that's really important to celebrate him and everything he stands for. During BLM, we had Patrick Hutchinson, who is obviously that protester, who'd helped that I want to call him counter protester, and that was kind of quite a quick reactive change during the pandemic to put someone on the cover who was relevant, that it felt wonderful. So in terms of favorite brands, I mean, I you know, I've been proud of a lot of things. I really liked when Elle, and it was, my God, you know, when you're like trying to think, where has the time gone?
Well, this year has like been sucked from out from underneath us, hasn't it? And like, what happened to last year? I don't know.
Exactly. But I loved when we put Stormzy on the cover of Elle magazine, and for lots of reasons. I love the fact that he was a male on the cover of a fashion magazine. I love the fact that he was a black male on the cover of a fashion magazine, a luxury title. And what we did with him was, it was him and his Black British collective. So it was celebrating all of those black voices in Britain that had done something amazing, whether they'd been an activist, or we had Jordan Dunn, or, you know, whatever it is, it was a whole range of people. And I thought that that was really significant and important to do, to basically reflect, you know, the society that we are in and all of the sort of diverse contributions that a whole range of people have given to this society. But also, I thought it was really interesting from a perspective that luxury and fashion is always seen as very elitist and not accessible. And something that I really believe in is that I'm here, I'm working in an industry that, you know, traditionally, you know, probably people, and there aren't a lot of people like me in this industry, but I think it's really important that if you want to attract greater diversity into an industry, you need to start reflecting that on your covers, within your content, within your teams, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think having him on the cover was amazing. And, you know, he gave us a shout out at Glastonbury that I'm always going to be proud of.
Did he? Oh my God.
Can I just say that amazing. I was there.
Oh, really?
I saw him at Glastonbury.
Yeah, it was such a great
person. Yeah.
I just think there are sort of moments, things that we've done, and it is, you know, it's either around taking a stand. You know, we had Sadiq Khan, who basically took a pop at Trump for Elle magazine and created a piece of content that sat on our channels, and, you know, Trump tweeted about it, and that caused a national debate. I think it's really important as a brand taking a point point of view, taking a stand, speaking up for the right moments, and just being brave, like being brave, trying something. It's not the tried and tested. It's about doing something new, something that feels right, something that's relevant, and something hopefully that will start a conversation or change perspective.
How do you plan for, prepare for, think about, you know, potentially controversial covers or stories that you're putting out from a comms perspective? So you and your team, are you constantly kind of crisis planning?
Yeah.
Reacting to things? What's the best advice you could give to other comms people who might be listening?
I would say the last year took us on a roller coaster. I think at our peak, and you know, it wasn't only COVID, it was definitely around BLM. We had to face a lot of tough questions, quite rightly, from our, you know, our readers and our audiences who were asking us questions. And sometimes we would have five or six separate issues a day that we were dealing with. And you know, that had a massive impact on the team as a whole, just because I don't think they had ever come across that sort of level of scrutiny or the fast pace of, and you think about the way that things happen nowadays, it very easily starts on social and then just escalates. And that's what we were finding. Things were happening in real time and escalating really quickly. So what did we do? We did a lot of planning. You know, we tried to predict, but sometimes you just can't predict how something will land. And that's the thing. It's like, as a comms person, sometimes you're being asked as your, you know, by your business to almost have a crystal ball and look into the future and predict how people will react. You can't predict human nature. So, you know, the only advice I would say is that if you think that you've got something that could potentially cause a conversation, a debate, cause controversy, scenario plan. And that's what we would do. So every, you know, thing, whether it was a cover, a piece of content, a partnership, or whatever it is, it's basically working through the various scenarios. It could happen and it could land like this, and this would happen, and what would we say if we did this, and what would happen if this question was asked? And you just really need to sort of work through it. And I think, you know, the thing that I definitely noticed with the team and, you know, myself, is that it had a massive impact on us and our sort of mental health as a team, because you always felt as though you were on a knife edge and there was always something coming in, and it was incessant. That's the thing. It was pretty much a roller coaster and there was no let up. And you know, your advice and your counsel that you're giving your business and your stakeholders affects your brand reputation. And I think the thing that we learn and that I tried to say to my team is essentially you have to sort of look at it in the bigger picture and look at what's happening in the world. And no matter how bad something might seem, how important it might seem, in the greater context, it isn't. There is so much more that is more important. And so, you know, if you don't view it in terms of sort of life and death, it's part of your role, it's part of your job, it's challenging, and you don't take it to heart and you don't take it personally and you don't feel that sort of burden and weight on your shoulders, then hopefully it can carry you through. But it is a challenge and it's tough. Anyone doing crisis comms, you know, I take my hat off to them and some of the things that brands have to go through, because it's a tough situation.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
What's like in your toolbox for being able to do that separation piece, to be able to not take things personally?
I think it's almost being able to take a step back, because when you're tied to a brand, you see everything through a lens of it, sort of, you know, it being, you know, like the end of the world for the brand, and it will, you know, greatly blah blah blah. I think you need to listen. So you need to take any feedback. If it's a criticism, sometimes it's justified, right? Sometimes it isn't, and people are saying things that aren't fair and aren't true, etc. But sometimes it's a legitimate concern or a criticism, and you have to take that on board in good faith and think about it. And if you're in the wrong for doing something, the one thing that I always say to my team and to the brands and whenever we've had situations, if you've done something wrong, it's much better to admit it and be transparent and try and make amends than to try and do the whole sort of PR spin and try and sort of, you know, slide your way out of it. It's not, that's not the way that good comms works nowadays.
Yeah.
If you're wrong and you've done something wrong, admit it and, you know, seek to kind of learn from it and try and make amends. Mm. That's the best way to deal with things. And you often find, and we were quite lucky that when we did get things wrong, that was the approach that we took.
Yeah.
And actually put us in good stead. So we would go back to the people and we would explain our position. We would apologize if we were in the wrong, etc. And actually it worked out with having a conversation.
It's the like explaining to people. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? But actually, like, I think for so long, like, especially like in the comms industry, people just assume that general public aren't going to understand. So they just like go from here and then they're like statement here. But actually, like, almost taking them along the journey with you. Yep, we've made a mistake. We don't quite have the answer yet, but we're like working through it and this is what we're going to do. And then when they see the result at the end, they genuinely believe that you cared about trying to do the right thing. And that's all people want, isn't it? People just want to know. And, you know, people need to have the explanation to be able to make their minds up.
And people also want to feel like they're being listened to and that their point of view, if it's something like if someone's taken the time, there are some people who do it just because they want to do it. But sometimes there are people who write into you and flag something because it is actually something that is important and, you know, like affects them and is important to them, you know, as a value or whatever it is. And, you know, that's for them to raise. Like, you can't really silence that. All you can do is listen and learn. And sometimes you may not always agree, but it's someone else's point of view. And that's the way that you have to see it, that that's what kind of makes us all so different, that we all have these different points of views. And there is sometimes no right answer. There isn't a right or a wrong. There are just lots of different perspectives.
I think it's fair to say that there's probably quite a lot of people, particularly leaders of corporates and big companies and things, that just think that it's PR's job to put out fires. And actually, it's not always about putting out fires, because you can't always put out a fire. What you can do is go down there, see what's happening, have a conversation with the people, explain why the fire is raging or whatever's happening. And then, like you say, try and learn from it next time. It's not about just like going all guns blazing and trying to completely stump out any conversation. There's always going to be conversation. There's always going to be people who disagree. And that should be the case. It should be a two-way conversation, shouldn't it? And that, at the end of the day, is our role, is to facilitate that conversation and to sort of build a relationship with people, because that's how you build a trusted relationship with consumers, isn't it? By just having that real conversation, being authentic, being open and honest and transparent, and having a bit of humility to accept when you've done something wrong.
Absolutely. That and that's the thing. I think as a brand, you can't expect to get it right the whole time. And I think as a comms person, that's what you have to realize. You're never going to be a perfect brand. There are going to be some times when you do really great stuff and great work and people are going to, you know, want to praise you for it. But then there are other times where, you know, it often isn't sort of, you know, bad intentions behind it, but you do something and it, you know, it wasn't the right thing or it wasn't the right tone or whatever. And you just need to take that on board and, you know, have that, like you said, humility and to learn from it.
Mm. I mean, we're having this conversation. We're like three women who are like calm, collected, like viewing things. We know how to have these conversations. We know how to communicate properly. And sometimes I am appalled with the way that politicians speak to each other. And I think, how come that is still allowed and that's still happening? They're running our country, and it just, like, imagine if they took the same approach that we had, like, not saying we're all perfect, but like took that approach of just not screaming and shouting at each other. It's disgraceful.
I actually think it's really relevant, because if you look at what's happened over the past year, if you look at how comms can really help and sort of save a brand and support a brand, you can also see the other side of it on how you can very quickly lose credibility and lose the respect of the nation and the people that have elected you by basically not listening to their points of view and not taking that on board. And I think a lot of politicians think that, you know, if they keep saying their point, keep saying it, keep reiterating it, suddenly, you know, everyone will agree. And it doesn't work like that, because not everyone is going to agree with everything that you do. But also there, it comes back to that thing about sort of different perspectives and things that you maybe haven't considered. And I think one of the sort of biggest learnings for the government is just how important comms is. You know, it's brands, but it's definitely the government. And that's why I think you've seen so much sort of investment and importance placed on all these press conferences and yada, yada, yada. But that's the thing. I mean, it really does make or break a person, a brand, a reputation, a government, etc. And that's why it's so important to get it right. And yeah, some people learn and some people don't.
The problem is that the way that the government communicates with the public has now become so formulaic. Everybody's been media trained to the nth degree in exactly the same way. They make their point in exactly the same way. They use the same intonation when they're talking to Andrew Marr. Every single one of them does. And actually, there's a complete lack of empathy, a complete lack of emotion. And I think you can actually go too far in that. You know, we can be too controlling. We can be too rigid in how we kind of train spokespeople and get and in our kind of brand guidelines and our messaging and all that type of thing. And then it just completely loses all of its authenticity, because there's no personality, there's no emotion, there's no empathy. And you know, ultimately, they could just stand up and say they've got it wrong. Imagine how game-changing that would be if someone just said, you know what, we did actually really mess that up.
And it would show a human side. I mean, I'm sure you guys, you can always tell when someone's been media trained within an inch of their lives and how it lands. And I think if you think about some of the great sort of politicians, like you think about an Obama and why he's just, you know, he's the comms person's dream. It's because even though, and he was heavily media trained,
of course,
the delivery and the tone and the way that he did it made you believe that it was authentic. And I think a lot of it was authentic. That's the sort of fine balance between a good spokesperson and a bad spokesperson, where, you know, you never get to see that sort of personality or human side. We're all humans. That's want to see.
It's kind of a bit sad really that I suppose, like, post Obama era, that actually that trend of being yourself, having personality, being human about things, you know, that didn't like catch on more in politics. Like, that would have been so great to see.
It's about electing the right leaders that, you know, actually, you know, will do the right thing and listen and have those conversations. So, you know, that's what I think a good leader is.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, making the position look inspiring enough that the potential leaders of the future would want to sign up for it. Because at the moment, I don't know many people that would be like, oh, yeah, that looks like a good job.
I mean, is comms something like people aspire to?
Probably not.
I don't know. Maybe.
I don't think anyone knows what we do, really, outside of comms, surely.
I think people have definitely got a better understanding this past year. Like, I think the best thing that has happened to our industry in a sort of weird way, out of all of the sort of negative stuff, is that people have actually started to value, like, comms, and that's businesses, you know, that's sort of people in general. I think people are really getting a sense of what we do and the importance behind it. And so I think that's great for us, and I think it's great for us as individuals and for an industry, because I think people now see the value in it. That's massively important.
100%. I agree with that. And the only thing I would add is, it used to be that people thought, and that perhaps what we spent all of our time doing was like shaping the narrative, but now we can actually be that like catalyst for change, for actually taking action, doing something different, and kind of creating that narrative, you know, like helping brands to take out. That's one of the first things that a lot of our clients did, was they picked up the phone to us and they said, what can we do? You know, what can we be doing to help support our community during this time? And that felt like, such a massive opportunity for us as an industry to sort of step forward and go, yeah, actually, you know, these are some things that we can do. Like, let's take action, not just talk about the things that we're doing. Let's actually help people, do something to make a difference, whatever it might be. Doing something super tangible, just feels like such a massive opportunity for the industry moving forward. And I think it's been created by the pandemic. So there's got to be some good things perhaps to have come out of it, an unintended consequence perhaps. Maybe that's one of them for our industry.
I think brands now, the good brands have now got more purpose and more accountability. And I think there are brands out there that genuinely, like you say, do want to make a difference and know the power of their brand, that they actually can make a change. And that's the thing, it's so important. You need the power of those brands wanting to sort of take an active part in helping communities or a cause or, a particular thing and making a difference. Otherwise, you know, what's it all about?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And not everybody can be Nike, but everybody can do something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Small things though, isn't it? It doesn't have to be on a sort of huge global scale, but it's small things. If lots of people did little things every day to make a difference, it would have a massive impact.
Yeah. We have talked a lot about making mistakes, learning from them, being open and honest. And Effie, I'd really like you to tell us about a time in your career about when you've had to admit defeat and eat a slice of humble pie.
Well, I was trying to have a think about this, and actually I would say for me, the whole past year and particularly what we went through with the pandemic and BLM, there were lots of lessons and lots of instances where we had to admit that we had got something wrong, right? We'd got something wrong. We hadn't, you know, it had been well-intentioned, or we hadn't done enough, or we should have been doing this. And, you know, I think for me, like as a sort of comms professional, it made me realize that I didn't have all of the answers. Like during BLM, like I'm a Black woman, but I just don't have all of the answers. I can't solve diversity. And I can't, be able to see sort of every intricacy around a conversation and debate. And I think the sort of biggest thing and the thing about, admitting when things aren't right is listening to a different perspective and listening to a legitimate concern. And actually saying, and there were so many times when I would turn around to our brands and say, you know what, that actually wasn't right. Like, I know it was well-intentioned, but we actually got it wrong. And so because we have got it wrong, we need to make amends. And that's what we did. So I can't say that there was any, like I said, it was so full on, but that whole period has been a learning experience, and there's been a lot of learning, but it's also, I guess, the positive side of it is I am now more proactive. I use my voice a lot more. I'm trying to make small changes. I'm speaking up for things. You know, if something doesn't feel right, if it doesn't look right, I'm not scared to use my voice. And I think that's really important. I think sometimes people will see things and not say something or not speak out or not try and take an action because they're scared or they think that it won't have an impact. But I just think we can all do little things, whatever is within our realms, and actually make a difference if we all do it. And you saw that during BLM. It's like, it's not one person, taking a stand and, going out to protest or speaking out or calling out, something. It's all of us using our collective voice. And I think that's really important. And I would hope with everything that's happened this past year that everyone has learned a certain degree of humility and has a slightly different perspective and more of a social conscience and understanding about the reality of what things are like for different communities in this world and how we can all actively make a change.
Thank you
very much.
Just feel like we needed a breath there at the end just to like absorb all that conversation. It's just so nice. Thank you.
Yeah, it has been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I hope we will speak to you again soon. But for now, thank you so much and take care of yourself.
That was such a great interview. I absolutely loved talking to Effie. And next up, we have our humble review. So this is anyone who is looking for something to watch, read, or listen to get you inspired about leadership. And as I said at the start, this one is a little bit of a stretch to get you inspired about leadership, but there are some good little nuggets in there. And this week, we've got The Bold Type, which is a Netflix series about three women who are like in the thick of their careers in the publishing world. And we chatted a little bit about it to Effie as well, who we know has also watched it. And then Sarah Collins couldn't resist but dive right in.
Yeah.
And now she's hooked.
Yeah, basically. I mean, and also, if for anybody that hasn't yet discovered it, a really brief and strong synopsis of it is Devil Wears Prada meets Suits. So for anybody that loved Suits or Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada, you need to get yourself over to Netflix and start watching this show. Or maybe you shouldn't if you don't want to get sucked into a vortex of The Bold Type and basically waste a lot of hours of your evening sitting watching trash. But it is fantastic, and it's definitely some light relief from all of the drama in the world. So yes, I can definitely recommend it now, and I'm pleased that I've watched it. Otherwise, I'd be sitting here not having anything to say whilst you gave our humble review.
No, it's very good, and it's kind of like semi-trash TV. So, you know, slightly lower your expectations on what to expect. But to be honest, I think everybody needs that trash that they can just watch episode after episode and, you know, forget about the world around them.
Exactly, yeah.
So that is it for another episode. You can catch us soon, and our podcasts are always available to listen to wherever you'd expect. So check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google, you name it, and we are there. And don't forget to follow us at Don't Cry Wolf Consultancy on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And if you want to get in touch with a guest recommendation or just say hi, it's hello@don'tcrywolf.com.
And tune in next time for our final episode of the series, where Harriet Courage and I will be serving up our own slice of humble pie and talking about times when we may have made mistakes. So that is a do not miss.
Oh my God. It's going to be a long episode.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.